Well, I want to thank the organizers. It's a pleasure to be here. It's been a wonderful conference. So now the title actually has a subtitle, which is Two Variations on the Zygo Limit Theorem. And the overview is because there are many geometers here, and it's late in the day, and so I would like to take a light approach to my talk. So I will first give an introduction about what the semiclassical limit is and the Zygo limit theorem. And then I'll talk about two variations on this, one having to do with perturbations over the hydrogen atom, and another having to do with symplectic cutting and applications to zeros of discrete orthogonal polynomials, which is kind of a surprise to me. So what is a semiclassical limit? Well, remind you what the basic ideas of quantization are. You have a symplectic manifold. I mean, if you're going doing quantization, you would like to associate a Hilbert space to it. And to every real-valued function on M, or a good class of functions on M, you would like to associate operators on the Hilbert space. The usual case is the Euclidean case, which is the one I will mostly use at the beginning. H can be taken to be L2 of Rn, so the Euclidean case with a standard symplectic form. And the quantization of observables, the best one is Weyl quantization, which is probably Victor is going to use that tomorrow. Maybe not. The second case that would also come up frequently here is, in my talk, is when M is scalar and polarized, meaning that there is a Hermitian, holomorphic Hermitian line bundle whose curvature is a symplectic form. And this is what Steve Zeldich used in his talk. But I'm interested in the operators. So then one defines the Hilbert space for every integer n to be the holomorphic sections of L tensor n. And the operator associated to a function Q. The curvature is a curvature. So L has it's a holomorphic Hermitian bundle, so it comes with a connection. And the curvature of that should be the symplectic form. And a standard way of associating operators to functions is what I have written down. Given a function Q, you form the operator. I can use this beautiful thing. You form the operator covariant differentiation with respect to the Hamilton field plus Q, multiplication by Q. And in general, this operator does not preserve the holomorphic sections. So you project it. Pi n will be defined on the next slide, conveniently, is the projection onto the orthogonal projection onto this space. And the operator inside is the operator that was discovered by Constant, that the mapping from Q to this first-order operator here is actually a Lie algebra, a faithful representation of the Poisson algebra functions on M. And on the semiclassical limit, one would like to essentially, one way to think about it is to reverse the arrow. So we would like to go from quantum to classical. Now, to do this, we need to introduce h-bar as a parameter. So h-bar is Planck's constant, and we saw it in action this morning in Victor's talk. And although it is in macroscopic units approximately 10 to the minus 27, and it is a constant of nature, it turns out to be a very good idea to think of it as a parameter and let it tend to zero. This actually has practical applications, as I have learned. Quantum chemists use semiclassical approximations in doing large-scale calculations. So this leads to a branch of analysis called semiclassical analysis, which is, I wanted to add this cryptic sentence, it's formally related to Hormander's macrolocal analysis by P equals H bar C. So, C being the conic variable in Hormander's theory, h bar being the parameter that lives in a neighborhood of zero, and p the momentum somehow can now be bounded. In fact, p equals zero is a fine region in phase space. Anyway, so let me. This is still part of the introduction, right? Let me remind you of a Zegel limit theorem. This is one of the basic direct spectral results that I know. In some sense, I think it may be easier than the Weyl formula that Victor quoted this morning. So let's think of a Kähler polarized with M. This is the version that I want to quote. L to M as before, where M compact. So we form the operator that we mentioned. And let the N be the dimension of the Hilbert space that depends on N. It's a polynomial in N. So the theorem is this. Suppose you take the eigenvalues, list the eigenvalues with multiplicities of this operator, and they depend on N. And by the way, I should say, didn't write it down, but here capital N is 1 over h bar. So the semi-classical limit will be the limit as N goes to infinity. So the theorem says this. So you list the eigenvalues, you pick any test function, and you form this weighted average by the test function of the eigenvalues, and then let N go to infinity. And the theorem says that in the limit, what you pick up is F composed with Q, so Q is the classical function, the classical observable that whose quantization gives rise to these eigenvalues, and then you get that limit, where d lambda is normalized, you will measure. There are some restatements of this conclusion. The first one is sort of obvious. Trace of F of Q hat is, so Q hat is really a matrix for each N, because the dimension of the Hilbert space is finite if M is compact. And so these are just restatements of this. This is sort of a weak limit, a push-forward measure. This is just notation. Anyway, the two results that I'll talk about are versions of this theorem where 1 of M or Q is singular. So in one case, N will be singular. In another, Q will be singular. And they will be mildly singular, so, but singular nonetheless. Excuse me?
Yes.
You wanted to look at that again. So what this is saying is basically that this is describing how the mu and j are distributed asymptotically. Okay, so let's look at the first at the first case. So I want to look at the hydrogen atom. Well, at the classical, oh my goodness, at the classical level, there's the classical and the quantum, and then the semi-classical lives between the two worlds, sort of between worlds. The classical version of the hydrogen atom, which is one star and one planet. It's let's call this the Kepler flow, and it's something that we teach in multivariable calculus if we have time. So it's a Hamiltonian flow on R to N minus the set x equals 0 given by this Hamiltonian. And I'll be interested in the periodic part of the motion. The phase space is split in two parts, the orbits that are periodic, the planet goes around the star, and then there are the comets that come and go swing around and never come back. But I'm interested in the periodic motion. And in fact, I'm going to be fixing an energy surface at minus 1/2. And, well, what I wrote is actually wrong. The flow is not 2-pi periodic, but it's mostly, almost everywhere 2-pi periodic. The problem is that this energy surface includes strict collision trajectories. This is the story of, you know, one of Ray Bradbury's short stories when the planet runs into the star in finite time. The surface itself runs off to infinity as the planet approaches its doom. Momentum goes to infinity. So it is this sort of singularity that makes the problem that I'm about to talk a bit challenging. So anyhow, back in 1970, Moser found out a beautiful way to regularize this motion, and we'll be using this. Essentially, what happens is that if you look at an orbit around the sun, if you look at the momentum actually moves on a circle. Not center at the origin, center could be center anywhere, but it moves around the circle. So this suggests that perhaps if you essentially exchange position and momentum, and then you do a stereographic projection onto sort of how the momentum space, then you might get something interesting. And this is exactly what happens, and that's what Moser did. First of all, the surface energy goes to the unit cotangent bundle of Sn. And then the next thing that happens is that after a time change, the Kepler trajectories go over to geodesics on the sphere. And the collision orbits correspond to geodesics to the North Pole. So one can take this new time, the time that comes from the geodesic time up in the cotangent bundle of Sn, and regularize the flow. And that's a useful thing to do. It's very nice. And in fact, one can show that if you pull back, so these you see, these, all of these things are canonical transformations. So if you pull back the Hamiltonian for geodesic flow from here, you get a Hamiltonian here. And that's what I'm calling H regularized. And what happens is that it's of the form G times H, where H is the original Kepler Hamiltonian. And G has the good taste to vanish on sigma. And so what happens to this, this is actually wrong what I wrote here. There should be a G, there's a typo here. There should be a G in front. But the two fields are proportional on the surface sigma. So there's a big typo right there. And now it's interesting though that one cannot regularize by a canonical transformation all or a band of negative energy surfaces. The choice of G depends on the energy, and so I'm going to say that the regularization is on shell. You just do one at a time. Now, what happens back in position space as you see this regularization is very beautiful. The particles and collision trajectories slow down as they approach the star, reach it with zero velocity, and then go back again. And so they perform a beautiful periodic motion, and they don't crash. They land perfectly and then take off immediately. Okay, so that's the classical picture, and now I want to look at the quantum. I'm not there yet. So what Moser did is that he looked at perturbations of the Kepler flow, so he added epsilon times another function. And using the regularization that I mentioned, he was able to analyze the dynamics for small epsilon and near this energy surface. And the key tool is something called the averaging method to show that this Hamiltonian is conjugated by a symplectic transformation to something that looks like this, where here Q became averaged along the trajectories, and that has the implication that Q averaged Poisson commutes with H. And using this, he was able to show that certain closed trajectories, that this guy, the perturbed Hamiltonian, will have certain closed trajectories. But I won't have time or need to explain that in detail. It's a beautiful thing. Okay, so now what about the quantum mechanical side? The quantum mechanical side, the quantum Hamiltonian is the Schrödinger operator with potential 1 over mod x. This is the Laplacian with a minus as well, the correct sign. Remind you that this actually was the first Schrödinger operator. That Schrödinger actually solved this for n equals 3, which is, and he was able to explain the Balmer series in the emission spectrum of the hydrogen atom. So the spectrum is known exactly. It's a little bit messy, but you know what matters to me is that it's like minus the eigenvalues, the discrete part, is minus a constant divided by h squared k squared, so it accumulates at zero. It has a ground state, and then it an infinite number of eigenvalues that accumulate at zero. And the multiplicity, so k is this quantum number from the bottom up, and the multiplicities grow, they're known explicitly, they grow like this power of the quantum, of the quantum number. Now, we're about to perturb this guy, so we're going to do the perturbation on the quantum side. And so that I, to make things nicer, I would like to pick a sequence of h bars going to zero in such a way, so this is the exact formula, but what matters is that there will be a connection between h and another quantum number, n, with the property that then negative a half is always an eigenvalue. Okay? And as h goes to zero, n goes to infinity, so the multiplicity of minus a half goes up. Okay? And, well, the distance from minus one half to its nearest neighbor is about O of h. So, we'll consider operators of this form, where q hat is a Weyl quantization of a function that has some assumptions on it. And epsilon itself will be taken to be small, a little smaller than the nearest neighbor spacing. So it's h bar to 1 plus a little bit, for any little bit. And so what happens then is that if we look at the spectrum of, so a hat is the perturbed hydrogen atom. If we look at that, at the spectrum of that, well, what happens is that this multiple eigenvalue minus a half with high multiplicity, it'll break, the multiplicity will break, and the eigenvalue will split, and you will have the eigenvalues will look like minus a half plus some shifts, mu and I. And mu and I are of the order of the perturbation. And so these are actually, so to speak, visible. They don't overlap with the next unperturbed with the next eigenvalues. So what is the theorem? The theorem that is a version of a Zagel limit theorem. This is a theorem with that I proved with my colleague, Mexican colleague, Carlos Villegas Blas, and it's going to appear in CMP. So it's you can see very much that it looks like the Zagel limit theorem. I'm looking at the distribution of these mu and I, which are the shifts from minus a half. I know we make them O of 1 dividing by epsilon, so now that this is sort of magnifying the little cluster of eigenvalues so that it fills a bounded interval. And we compute the Zagel limit of those. And the answer is that it is F of composed with Q average integrated over sigma minus collisions. So what is Q average? Q average turns out to be the average of Q along trajectories with respect to the physical time. So, you know, this is very much like result from I guess it was in the late 70s of Alan Weinstein, Colin de Verdier, and that looked at Laplacian. There was no H bar in the results. It was Laplacian plus potential on the n sphere. There's a similar theorem. I don't have time to write it, but I actually wrote my thesis on things like that. So I'm sort of going back to some of these things. I mean, I did go back in this particular work. And as a corollary, well, under some assumptions, you actually can estimate, you know, how many eigenvalues are there. I want to say something about the proof. But again, I don't want to give too many details because the proof I think is very interesting. Well, I like it. I like the ingredients that go in. I should say the ingredients that go in. This step is boring. So there are a few boring steps. You sort of dilate things, you know, to bring in the see what happens with the hydrogen atom is that so the d's are dilation operators and you can sort of dilate h bar away. So we do some of that, and so that this is the guy we really want to study. We can conjugate it to something that looks like this. So now we actually have the the hydrogen atom without H bar plus a perturbation here that looks kind of ugly, but it's okay. And now the clusters are now around eigenvalues En that actually move with N, right? They're not fixed. The first step is to replace this perturbation by something that commutes with the non-semiclassical hydrogen atom, and that is, unfortunately, we can't really do the averaging method. So, but there is some sort of commutator argument that says, so pi n projects onto the eigenspace of the unperturbed operator without H bar, and so this is actually the perturbation that we have, and we simply brutally compress it to this space, and there is some more or less standard argument that says that if the taus are the eigenvalues of this guy, then the weak limit we're after, we can replace the original perturbation by this one that has the nice property that it now commutes with B. So B actually turned out, I think I put it in there. B is a hydrogen atom without H bar. And then, we want to use Moser's idea, but at a quantum level. And it's a little bit tricky in some sense, because again, this regularization is only a nice canonical transformation sort of on shell, as I mentioned before. However, there is a beautiful transformation due to Falk that maps the eigenspaces of, this should be a B actually, of the standard non-semiclassical hydrogen atom to spaces of spherical harmonics. However, I don't understand the structure of this transformation globally. It's defined one, it normalized one eigenspace at a time by hand. So this is a bit of a problem. You cannot just simply quote microlocal analysis theorems. You have to do something a little bit more. So that's what I said here. This is not a globally a Fourier integral operator, but more or less, whatever that means, we prove that it's one on shell, or it is one on shell. And to make sense of this, we use my friends, the coherent states of the sphere. So let me just show you what that is. So let's look at the following model of the unit tangent model of SN. So basically, I want to think of now complex vectors in CN plus 1. The real part will be the position and the imaginary part of the position vector on SN, and the imaginary part will be correspond to a covector. So we want them to have both length 1 and orthogonal. This is your ordinary dot product. And now this is convenient because for each one of these n complex vectors and k a non-negative number, we can define the following function on the sphere. It is basically alpha, this is the dot product, omega to the kth power with some normalization condition. And it is very, very easy to see that this function is a spherical harmonic of degree k. And in fact, as for k large and alpha fixed, it will concentrate along the great circle, the geodesic, corresponding to alpha. Now, what we do, right, so these coherent states have the following orthogonal, the following reproducing kernel. They actually form a, you can write the projection onto the spherical harmonics using these guys. These are the phis, using these phis. So you integrate, for each alpha in the unit cotangent bundle, you have one of these states. If you integrate with respect to the natural measure here, you get a function of WW prime that I've on the screen, and that is the reproducing kernel or the orthogonal projection kernel. On the other hand, let's introduce the psi functions, which are the functions corresponding to the phis under the Falk transformation, which I won't define the Falk transformation. But it is, well, I won't define. If you do the same thing on the same calculation, the same construction, I should say, integrating over the alpha, but now you do it with the psi's, what you get is the projection onto the eigenspace of the hydrogen atom on the Fourier transform side. So these guys, these psi, the phis and the psi's, are giving us concrete ways of realizing these projections as an integral, as integrals over the unit cotangent bundle of the sphere. So what we actually do is we take, we want to understand this guy, the spectrum of r hat n, and we use the expression for the projection that we had before, and so now we form this kernel. This is actually transforming the Rn into an operator on the unit tangent bundle. And so this operator on the unit tangent bundle will actually be the Schwarz kernel of a Bresin-Teplitz operator or the reduction of the unit tangent bundle. So we're able to go just on shell from this guy to the average perturbation to the sphere using the coherent states. And then we treat the problem on Sn, well, there are a few other minor complications, like the symbol of the operator fails to be smooth at the North Pole, but now that everything is compact, this is not a problem, and it all works. Okay? So that's the first part. Now I'd like to talk about another variation of this and an unexpected application. So now I would like to start with a polarized Kähler manifold, and we'd like to assume that we have an S1 action. So you can forget about hydrogen. So now phi stands for the moment map. And since I am assuming that S1 preserves everything, then is represented on the holomorphic sections, and I write the infinitesimal generator in this fashion so that An has a real spectrum consisting of integers. Now I would like to pick a regular value of phi, and I want to project, so this is going to be sort of related to the symplectic cutting part of the subtitle there. And I want to project onto the span of the eigenfunctions of the S1 generator with eigenvalue less than or equal than nc, where c is a parameter that I fix. I also would like to introduce a part of the phase space which corresponds to this quantum condition, which is where the moment map is less than or equal to c. So it's everything below level c. And then we have the following theorem. Now there, you notice the quote marks because I haven't written all the details. But I'm very confident this is true. So it is a kind of a Zeigler limit theorem, but where we're compressing, so we pick a Q and then we do this quantization. And I would like to compress it to that part of the Hilbert space where the eigenvalues of the S1 are below C times N. And then, well, so as you take the limit of that, then what you get is the same kind of integral, except that it's only restricted to the allowed region in phase space. And the normalization has to be a little bit different. Now, I claim that this is true without the assumption that Q commutes with phi. Because, well, you'll see. So I think I don't need to say this to this audience. I think everybody knows why this should be true and makes sense. The first statement is not exactly precise as it is. The range, the space of where the S1 generator takes values less than or equal than Cn, you can think given the scale at which we're working, it can be considered as a quantization of a symplectic cut. And the operator that we're looking at compressing Q hat to this, well, we would like to think of it as a quantization of Q pushed down to the symplectic cut, but Q may not pass to the symplectic cut because Q and C may not commute. But, you know, the Zagel limit theorem is observing the spectrum at a certain scale for which this lack of precisions essentially won't matter. So what is the application of that theorem that I find amusing, right? Interesting, unexpected. So now let's forget about everything that I've said so far and let's look at Jacobi matrices. So Jacobi matrices are symmetric tridiagonal real matrices where the off-diagonal elements are positive. They're very interesting. They have simple spectrum, so I want to define the weighted spectral measure. So let lambda be the eigenvalues, and let Wj be a first component of a normalized lambda j eigenvector. And so then one forms the weighted spectrum. This is all very classical, eh? Or the weighted spectral measure is a spectral measure, delta functions at the lambda j's with the weights, which are these components squared. And a beautiful theorem, a simple fact, is that we've gone from L, this Jacobi matrix, to the M, and in fact, one shows that that's a bijection. So you can recover L from the M, and given a DM of this sort, where the lambda j's are distinct, it comes from a unique L. Now, as part of this reconstruction process, by the way, I didn't write the word tota, the tota lattice here, but it's of course intimately related to this construction. So, how does one? It turns out that when you go back, when you want to go from the spectral measure back to L, the thing to do is to apply Gram-Schmidt to these monomials in lambda with respect to dm. So given dm, you can do this. And it turns out that even though you have, you know, you have only, you know, 2n, essentially 2n, 2 times n pieces of data, you know, you have conditions at n plus 1 points the way I wrote it, you can actually do this up to a point. These are well-defined. The Gram-Schmidt procedure is well-defined up to that point. And these are the discrete orthogonal polynomials, or DOPs, of the subtitle. And I won't go through how you reconstruct this because it's not relevant for us, but up to a constant, PK turns out to be the characteristic polynomial of the principal case minor of L. So you're actually cutting this matrix L into, you look at the sequence of minors, and the characteristic polynomials turn out to be those guys. And the PKs are satisfy, well, there's a recurrence relation with the A's and the B's, which is how you reconstruct L from the weighted spectral measure. There are, this is a fascinating subject with many interesting examples. I want to mention one, which is the so-called Kroschak polynomials. I'm not sure how I should be pronouncing that. So what is the L that gives rise to these polynomials? Well, you take a representation of little su2 and take a linear combination of the first two Pauli matrices and then write that in the representation as a matrix in a basis where sigma 3 is diagonal, and then do what I said before. So these are orthogonal polynomials, discrete orthogonal polynomials that are associated to a couple of, well, there are three parameters, I guess, which linear combination you take, and or two parameters, and which representation of SU2 you take. And people in the subject are interested in the situation where you have very large L matrices, and in fact, passing to the limit. So how does one set up a large n limit? So my matrix L was essentially n by n. Well, the way one does this is you simply think that your A's and B's are values of some, say, smooth functions on 0, 1 sampled at evenly spaced points. And then one can ask lots of questions about the large n limit and the total lattice system, for example, associated to the corresponding tridiagonal matrix. And the problem is, what is the limit distribution of the zeros? Well, the problem that I raised today is what is the limit distribution of the zeros of the associated discrete orthogonal polynomial? So you have one, well, for each n, you have a family of n orthogonal polynomials. This was figured out by people in the field, Kuglers and Van Assen, in 1998, in a paper that, in a formula that is, well, you'll see. So the result is known for this case, but what is beautiful to me is that you can get it immediately from this point of view of Zygo theorems and symplectic cuts. And the formula itself is not that pleasant. I'll show you at the very last slide, but I find that the quantum picture, the semi-classical picture, is very nice. So, you need a space if you want to relate what I just said to... if you want to relate the discrete orthogonal polynomials or the Jacobi matrix construction to what I said before, the simplest case is that of CP1. You could also do this on the complex plane, and you could get limits of other famous polynomials. Anyhow, so I would like to consider action angle variables on CP1. Okay, so x is the height function, standard. And I given A and B, I would like to consider this observable. Now, there are some boundary conditions that one has to be concerned about. The way I've written things, one would like this function to be regular at the north and the south pole. So that means that, there's some easy to write condition on what B should look like at the minus one half and one half. So now I would like to look, so we do this Beresing-Toeplitz quantization, I get Q hat, and then I would like to look at the standard basis of H0, which is where the S1 action is diagonal. And it turns out to be that it is exactly, well, up to some correction terms that won't matter in the limit, it is exactly the L with these guys. So if you apply the cut version of the Zygo limit theorem, you immediately get the weak star limit of the distribution of the zeros of the associated polynomials. Now, in what regime? Well, so basically you need precisely, actually, if you're going to cut at level phi equals c, then you get the distribution of these guys as the ratio k over n is basically c as n goes to infinity. So if you really want to see the formula, there it is. You can actually compute it precisely. I ran out of material, so that's all I have. You'll be happy to. We didn't push it that far, but it should be doable. One of the technical difficulties in this thing, at least for us, is that this is what I think Victor did exactly what you said for Laplacian plus potential on the sphere. But there you have the full force of the averaging method. You can conjugate, you can average with respect to a group of free integral operators. Yeah. And here, however, because of the
Actually, get to singularity, it needs precisely get the angular momentum zero.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, you have a pretty small part of space.
It's true.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Molecule or atom? Hydrogen atom?
Oh, it's another typo. I mean, I mean the atom, of course.
Atom?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yes, Steve?
Just a little other reference
about
the paper, Stringer. You know? No. Stringer, I don't know what its relation to Fox is. But you know, people were
trying to understand why
the
Johnny Bacon
hydrogen
basis. Absolutely.
And he also directly gave a relationship between the
moon coast and the possibly the only relevant kernel of the
weak
spin
part of the
hydrogen
atom.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Other questions? Okay, thanks. See you again.